Welcome to the Agile Wire, brought to you by Wisconsin Agility. We want you to get agile and stay agile. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Chad Beyer.
And we're recording. All right, kick us off, Jeff.
All right, we have Prateek Singh back on the podcast. Prateek's here to talk about his new book, Scaling Simplified. Great book. Love it. Prateek. But if I was going to boil this down to like one sentence, like the book's boiled down to one sentence. Tell me if you think this is accurate or not. Scale flow of value. Don't scale people or teams.
Yeah. You're done. You're done.
You don't have to listen to
this. And we're done.
Thanks for listening today, everybody.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, that's done. We're done. Yeah. That's it. It could have been a much shorter book.
Yeah, I mean, it took you 300 plus pages to say that, you know.
I am curious to build on Jeff's opening here. Did you ever think of a subtitle for the book? Like, were you toying around with a subtitle?
I was. Actually, the current subtitle actually on it is A Practitioner's Guide to Scaling Flow. And I probably didn't do a good job of marketing that. But to Jeff's point, the whole book is about scaling flow. At the end of the day, our customers pay us to get stuff done for them. How we get it done is not as important as actually when we pick something up, it actually gets to the customer. Whether it takes 20 teams to do it or 10 teams to do it or one team to do it, it's flow. It's scaling that flow that matters to our customers. And that's essentially what the book is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. So it's not your fault. I just didn't look at the subtitle on the cover of the book. I read the top and then I just like didn't look at the bottom of the cover, I guess.
Hey, if it makes you open the book and read it, good enough.
Yeah.
If the main title is so good that you just want to open the book and read it and not even read the subtitle, good. Mission accomplished.
Yeah, no, yeah, perfect. I did get to a section that I was like, oh, this is a cool, like, I was thinking if there was a subtitle, which there is, but I got to a section in chapter, I don't know what chapter, but there's a heading called Lead with Flow.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty powerful, like those words, lead with flow. And anyway, like your thoughts on, if you know what section, I think it's the end of chapter 7 I'm looking at right now.
Yeah. The whole idea with leading with flow is, another way of saying leading with flow is make everything else subservient to flow. You know, as we were saying earlier, you know, the thing that matters is flowing value to customers. Now, everything else is just random stuff that we put in place so that value flows to customers. And if that random stuff is getting in the way of flowing value to customers, well, let's get that stuff out there. Let's lead will flow and make everything else subservient to flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a really powerful thing, because so often in our work, when we go into clients and they give us pushback of why they can't do that, it's secondary and tertiary things. It's like, well, how would we do shared code ownership? Or our developers are going to have to learn so many new skills to be able to do this. Or, I mean, they'll give us whatever. It's some other pushback. And it's like, yeah, but don't you pay people to deliver value for your customers? Like, isn't that the reason they exist? Like, why don't we align around that and then figure out how to make everything else work, you know, with that as our primary goal? So I think, I mean, it's key. It's a little bit of common sense, I think, when you're doing scaling, but it's not so common, right? So...
scaling particularly when it comes to scaling in software development in Agile has been tied to these rules and structures and frameworks that need to exist in order for you to be able to do this. Meanwhile, I mean, large corporations have been delivering decent amount of software for a long time without these scaling frameworks being in place. So obviously it's doable, and it's doable if we are doing the things, Jeff, that you were just talking about, which is focusing on getting value to customers and everything else. And I think this is early on in the book, I talk about making progress via negativa, It's like, remove everything else that's getting in the way of flow. Instead of trying to add processes, let's first talk about removing processes so that things can flow.
Yeah, I love that. I have highlights from the book because I finished it this morning. So can I just throw like one-line zingers that you wrote in the book and then you can just comment on them?
Sure.
I think this will be fun.
This is going to be great.
So I have one highlighted here. It's blockers are usually just a specialized form of dependencies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else? I mean, you know what? That's just great writing. I can't add anything to that.
Mic drop. But it is, right? I mean, it's so funny how, like you're just saying, removing the things that are in the way. Well, why are things in the way? It's usually because of all these dependencies, right? Yep. Like when organizations are just filled with blockers of dependencies around these specialized forms of dependencies. So I don't know. I like that one. I'm sure there's more to that paragraph, but that was the one I highlighted.
Yeah, it's as you said, Chad, when this is the problem with scale. And this is why scaling frameworks have become so successful, is because people do realize, you know, executives realize things are blocked all over the place. Things are not getting done. We need to find out how to get things done. And then we invest a lot of money in adding a whole bunch of process to figure out how things are not getting done, instead of just going in and saying, that's blocked. Why is that blocked? Let's just get whatever is the reason for that being blocked out of the way. There's a dependency. Let's remove it. And if you do that a few times, turns out you end up, every dependency you remove turns out ends up remaining, removing 100 other dependencies.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. It's like reverse engineering your way towards agility by just slowly but surely chipping away at all those dependencies until, you know, you've almost, like, I don't know if you can remove every dependency in theory, but striving for that perfection goal, right? And just continuous improvement mindset.
I also think it's interesting, this kind of goes along with this point, the way you talk about efficiency. So I think it's an overloaded word, and kind of like agilis, right? Like in Kanban and whatever, pick your word inside of our community. They're all overloaded. They mean so many different things for so many people. But I really like the way that you talk about it. And what most people will probably think about when I'm saying the word efficiency is efficiency of utilizing people, resources, something along those lines, some type of activity that we do. And that's not at all what you talk about in the book. So maybe you could dive into that. What does efficiency mean to you, Prateek?
Yeah, efficiency. That's, for me, efficiency is when I arrive at the airport, how quickly I get through check-in and security onto the to the flight waiting area, or onto the flight even. How quickly I get there is efficiency. How busy the TSA agents are, how busy the check-in people are, how busy the people at the gate are, that has nothing to do with efficiency. In fact, the busier those people are, the less efficient it is for me to get through. I might have TSA pre, I might have clear, all that stuff, but if those people are busy, it's going to take me a long time to get through. It's the movement of whatever is the encapsulation of value. That is efficiency. When you are working on a work item, how efficiently that work item moves, because the customer is waiting for the work item. The customer is not paying you to be busy. The customer is paying you to get that work item done. So, Jeff, exactly to your point, people being busy, the TSA gate agent, the TSA agent being busy, the gate agent being busy is not efficiency. It's individuals and work items being able to make it from point A to point B. That is efficiency.
It's the value being efficiently delivered, right?
Yep.
And then I think a lot of people then will go, like, even in like our community, people are like, well, then, are we talking about flow efficiency? And then you kind of like talk about the book, how you flip it. It's like, no, it's the flow of efficiency, not flow efficiency. So it's like you flip the words. It's efficient flow, you know, like, so I think that's just really a powerful thing. And so what you would monitor there, right, would be work item age.
Yeah.
Like looking at blockers, like all the things we just talked about, doesn't it always come down to those things?
It's so funny. It's turtles all the way down, right? It's like, it's whatever works at that team level. Again, since all we're talking about is how efficiently work items move, whatever is works at the team level, you can apply the same practices at any level. You might just be looking at different work level of work items. Instead of looking at stories, you might be looking at features or epics or initiatives, whatever that is. And now we're talking about how do these get across?
Yeah. All right. Building on this, not keep just doing busy work or even wasteful work, there's a section on the waste of prioritization. And you close that paragraph out with the following statement, which anybody who's listens to your podcast, the you and Dan, right? I'm sure this is not going to be a shock, but it reads, there are two ways to make a backlog healthy. Ignore it or delete it. Thoughts? Could you expand on that one?
Before I get there, I promised you I'll say this. You know, Dan was supposed to be here. He's not here, and everything is better when Dan is not here. But I'm sure we'll have Dan on here soon, and he can talk about his new book as well, Actionable Isometrics Predictive Volume 2. But yeah, that chapter is I shouldn't say it's my least favorite because it is one of my favorites, but it is the biggest bait and switch chapter I have in the book, because I spend a good amount of time describing all these prioritization techniques and, you know, how you would do this and where you should go to read about this stuff. And I end it with saying, you know what? None of it matters. Don't do any of it. Just it's a complete waste of time. And the reason we get to that is anytime you do prioritization on work that you have not started, you are either explicitly or implicitly making a commitment. You're either someone looking at that backlog is going, oh, I am number 10 on this. Cool. So when they get through 9 things, they'll pick up my thing. Or it's an implicit thing that you've told the team that this is the order in which, you know, you all should pull this work. When you do that, when you make that commitment, and then because of real world, things happen, priorities change, especially if we are being agile and we actually learn that makes us change things. If we actually hold true to the values of learning from customer feedback, that thing number 10, you're probably never going to get to it. You might never even get to thing number 5, especially when we're talking about scale at for higher level items. You might never get to number 3. And that's why all that prioritization stuff is great, but you cannot really say that our backlog is prioritized, because as soon as you make that commitment, you're shooting yourself in the foot. Think about it this way. I don't know if I say this in the book or not. You're essentially saying we're not going to be agile. You're essentially saying this is a priority order, and I'm going to stick to this priority order no matter what. So that's why for me, a healthy backlog is one that you never create.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would go quite the not create. I would say that it's very short and emergent in nature is how I would phrase it. But I think I like the spirit of where you're going. I think we have to have some strategy, some direction, and then know that we're going to completely change it because we have to be adaptable as we learn. The problem that I see a lot of organizations get into is they're not to the point where they're validating their outcomes. So they're delivering, but they're not actually measuring. And so if they're not doing that, then what the heck am I going to work on next? And so it's like, well, we got to get you to the point where you understand how to validate, and then you can give it time to, you know, be out in the wild for a while to learn what you should do next.
I'll amend that statement a little bit to say you can have a backlog. You just don't need to necessarily order it. You don't necessarily need to prioritize it, because obviously when you're done with something, you need some way to find out where do I need to go pull the next thing. I mean, we do need to find, otherwise what, people just gonna sit around idle? No, we just find out when we'll pull the next thing, what the next thing is to pull. But in general, Jeff, in the spirit of what you were saying, we really don't need this deep prioritization. Hey, let's get together every 3 months and figure out what we're gonna do for the next 3 months or the next 6 months, whatever that is.
So that's interesting, because there's also, this is a question I had. You talk about, I think it was maybe when you're talking about like a portfolio stand up or something like that. And maybe like you're at that point where like, hey, we're ready, right? There's a signal. We can pull more work now. What should we pull next? Maybe I missed it, But I don't think anywhere in the book you talk about who makes decisions. You just talk about the decisions being made. And was that deliberate? Is there more to the story?
That is absolutely deliberate. I tried to keep all roles out of there. In fact, as far as events goes, I think portfolio stand-up is the only event that mentioned. But even that is like, hey, do it whenever, whatever makes sense to you. Don't have to do it daily. Don't have to do it weekly. But I deliberately kept roles out of it because inevitably you put a role in a book or in a technique, someone's going to come up with a certification to certify you in that role. and that's going to become, oh no, but for example, and I know this is the most common example, that's why I'm using it, Scrum Master. And every Scrum Master certification from different agencies or whatever kind of ends up being a little different. And then a Scrum Master is supposed to do this and not that. Even though there's a 13-page guide that tells you exactly what a Scrum Master is supposed to do, it changes. To me, I don't think the roles are as important. I think the activities are a lot more important. We were talking about the work moving through the system. What happens to the work is a lot more important than who does that.
So clean slate, imagine no agile terminology exists, right? It's like we're in an alternate dimension. Practically, what have you seen with like in those moments where, hey, we're ready to pull something? Like, have you seen small teams of, you know, four make quick decisions? Have you seen steering committees work effectively? Have you seen some type of product owner role where there's one person who really is the decision maker? What have you seen in practice mostly?
Yes to all of them. And different ones have worked in different places. What has been great, what one place where I did this, it was great because we used to have a portfolio stand up on Mondays. Every week on Monday, and that was kind of, I think it was like 10 a.m. or something. It was a way to kick the week off almost. And this company had five different departments, and every department was complaining about development's not doing my stuff. They're not doing my stuff. So everyone had the same complaint. So with that portfolio stand up, what ended up happening was we started bringing everyone together to show, hey, we're at capacity. The five of you need to figure out what is the best use of our time as soon as someone frees up. And the real power in that stand-up was the fact that the CEO and the CTO would join it. So, you know, instead of people running to complain to their parents, the parents were right there. So the conversation was right there. And inevitably, everyone had their top thing, and they would be able to make the call of, okay, right now, we are in X kind of season, so right now, this thing is most important, let's do this thing. Or right now, we have to focus on customer retention, this thing is most important, let's do that thing. So every week, they knew kind of what is going on and what we need to pull next. And at the beginning of the week, even the teams were able to signal, hey, looks like we're very close to getting done on this thing. So it seems like somewhere in the middle of the week, we'll need to know what to pull. So either tell us now or get back to us by tomorrow and let us know what we pull.
Sure. Yeah, I think the thing I like about it is, even if it is group decision making where you have, let's say, two or three executives who need to work it out and make the call, or even with the team members might have to make a call once in a while, the sense of urgency around the decision is so much higher because it's like, we're ready to pull something. If we don't decide, we could just sit here and do nothing, but we'll probably just pull what we think is the best thing. But it forces the decision versus, like you're saying, if we're doing these huge, big upfront plannings where we're talking about work that's going to happen 6 months from now, what are we even talking about? Like, we're not even really making decisions. We're just moving the chairs around on the, you know, on the deck of the Titanic, right? Is that the phrase?
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. And again, this particular example I mentioned is obviously a relatively small shop. You know, your CTO and CEO of a large company is not going to show up to every, this was a 200 people company. So it was doable for them. But then in larger companies, when we're talking about a company that's 12,000 people, that's where the product owner model works a lot better. we have this entire area. This product owner takes in the input from everyone and goes, oh, this is what's the highest priority right now. Great. Whenever the team asks for work, I'm going to pass this along.
Yep. Awesome.
So one of the biggest difference that I've seen, I see in what you were writing about compared to what Chad and I generally do, in full transparency, when we're working with an organization, we don't follow one scaling framework at all. It's more like, what do they need? And most of it aligns to something less-ish, right? So like something pretty close to less. But we would say generally it's the team thing. So that's probably one of the bigger differences that we would have is we'd say, yeah, we want cross-functional teams. We want to deliver on that. And I like your idea of a large team and having people kind of dynamically reteam to work on whatever makes sense in the moment. I just haven't seen many organizations have the maturity to handle that. I just wish they did, but I haven't seen that. And I'm just curious what your experience has been.
So this is it's very interesting, and you all mentioned Dan in my podcast earlier. We say a lot of really out there stuff. Like there, we say we're drinking whiskey, so things come out. We say a lot of things that are way out there, and I would say most of it inspired by Dan, but then I egg him on that. But the thing that we get probably the most feedback on, probably the most questions around, are the team size things. It's this thing that we have tried in a few places where we've had teams that are 15, 20, 30, 40, even 60 people large. And there's always this question of, well, how does that even work? How does that? And if you have that many people, how do you make decisions quickly? How does that? And how do you get them to socialize together? I don't think enough people have tried this using the same things that they do for small teams. For example, anytime you have a small team, you'll do some social group construction stuff. Mm-hmm. You will limit WIP. You will make sure that there are very few things going on so people can collaborate. You will do offsite activities. You will do collective understanding of the work. All those things can also be done with larger groups, whether you want to call them teams or not, or teams of teams or whatever that is. All those same things, if done with larger groups, can lead to similar results. But that's just the team level. The reason Dan and I like to talk about this is because it cuts down on exactly what Chad was talking about earlier, which is dependencies. All of a sudden, I don't have to wait for this other team to give me stuff because that person is right next to me. We can figure out how we most efficiently manage it. We've done this in a couple of places. It seems to have worked pretty well there. But to your point, Jeff, it's not as much maturity of the team members. It's more maturity of management that is required to support it.
Yeah. 100%.
Yep.
Yeah, and we're all for, I mean, back to your, you know, the statements you make. I love it when the statements are big and out there because I think that's like, I think I used the phrase perfection goal earlier, but like, I love setting the bar so radical that, you know, even the smallest step forward towards that is a decent amount of change. Like, for example, and here's another zinger or a quote from the book. For the vast majority of organizations, eliminating upfront planning is absolutely revolutionary, right? I totally agree with that. So if that's so revolutionary, then painting a picture that's really radical makes them consider, well, what if we just take a small step towards that? Like, you don't even need backlogs. Wow, that's radical. That takes away upfront planning, right? We don't even have a backlog to put stuff on. Like, then we can't do upfront planning, but you make them think, do we need a backlog? And then maybe they take a smaller step to that where instead of having a backlog with 1,000 items on it, maybe it's 50 items. And that's improvement because now there's less, right? There's less noise. So I like the big, I don't know. I like the revolutionary statements because I think it gets people in the mood to change or they start considering change instead of just closing it off.
And that's, to your point, and I I will give Dan a lot of credit on this because you know, I used to be a much nicer guy before I hung out with him, but But the thing with Dan, at least the way I have seen him progress with this stuff, and he has pulled me along with it too, is those revolutionary statements are, from a very pure lean perspective, just normal. Like from an absolute pure lean perspective, these are just normal, natural things. Well, if you're completely just in time, why would you have a backlog? And if no one has a backlog, how can there be dependencies? And if there's a dependency, well, lean says eliminate it. Let's get rid of it. Let's make a larger team so it doesn't exist. And again, I'll give Dan a lot of credit for making me think that way. And once I think I started thinking that way, it just makes sense. If you do everything just in time, you can be as agile as possible.
Yeah. I mean, you think about, well, why do we have backlogs? It's so we have shared understanding of what to do next. Well, is that the leanest approach to knowing what to do next? No, there's a better way, right? So I like it. I just think that it's a big step forward. And so I think a lot of organizations would struggle, but I think to Chad's point, if they could even get it to a handful of items that they're planning, it would make a huge, huge difference of where they're going, you know, instead of planning years in advance, you know, and of things you're never going to do. So.
It's even even in our trainings, when we do Kanban training, Dan and I have a slide which shows an options column with three or four things in it. We know that if we don't show that column, the next question will be, well, how do I figure out what's next? Well, then you'll have to go to the entire spiel and write a book to explain it. So just to get, help people to step there, yeah, there is a middle step that you can take.
All right, I didn't even see this zinger, but Chad told me about it before, and then I had to look it up. Did he really say that? And I was like, wow, shots fired over the bow here. Like, let's see
Oh,
what
you're going to
happens.
bring
So
that one up?
I'm
Oh
going to
boy.
bring that one up. So at the very end in the
In
acknowledgments,
the
you say,
acknowledgments.
yeah, you say, thank you to the creators of Safe. Without your misguided framework, I would not have anything to write about. So, you know, I mean, there's something.
You wrote it.
I did write it. I did write it. And here's the funny thing. So this is, again, as I was saying, I give a lot of credit to Dan for a lot of stuff. And as I was writing this, I was like, I should run this by Dan. And I was like, I know the answer I'll get from him. He'll be like, yeah, absolutely. Put it in. And so I was like, no, I need someone who can potentially give me a different answer. So I ran it by my wife. And I was like, hey, you're the much nicer of the two of us. So do you think this is okay? She's like, yeah, it's okay. I'm like, all right, then it's going in. But the point of it again is it's I again it's very as agilists, we all like to not call things out when they are prevalent in the industry because we like to be nice. But sometimes I think you make progress by not being nice. In fact, a lot of times you make progress by not being nice, because Agile itself wouldn't have come along if people just kept playing nice and said, oh, no, I don't want to hurt my project managers, and I don't want to hurt the people with the Gantt charts, and we shouldn't do that. The thing that Safe did really well is marketing, and they made scaling Agile literally a thing before we all knew it was a thing. But then they added a whole bunch of stuff to it, and I was like, great, people now know about it. So let me actually try to level the score here. I don't think I'll be able to, but let's at least try to bring a different set of eyes on it, because scaling agile seems to have lost the agile part of it, and it's just become a scaling. And that's kind of why, yeah. But thank you for them. Thank you. If they hadn't done it, people wouldn't even think about this stuff.
Yeah, and it, you know, I mean, we know plenty of people who have worked with Safe, implemented Safe. To each and everyone's own, right? Like, you can choose whatever you want. Like, I've kind of moved past the whole like bickering over stuff. You can choose whatever you want. I feel pretty strongly that there are leaner and more effective ways to squeeze more agility out of an organization. If you can do it with Safe, great. And that level of agility that you're getting is good enough for your organization. No problem here. I don't care ultimately, right? But I just think most of our clients, they want more than that. And so it'd be a disservice to only help them improve a little bit when you can go so much farther. right? Without a lot of the overhead and waste. So,
yeah, it actually ties back to the very first chapter. I talked about Via Negativa earlier. It's that story of Michelangelo that they asked him, "Hey, how did you carve the sculpture of David?" And he was like, "Well, David was already there. I just took the parts that are not David out." And I'm fine if you're doing safe. Just start removing stuff. Start removing stuff that doesn't help, doesn't matter, gets in the way of flow. And you'll probably end up with something that is a lot more customized for you, works in your context a lot better, and is probably a lot cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think I had one other quote that I really enjoyed. It's there's so much to it because you have an entire section on it, but you talked about Conway's law, you talked about Little's law, obviously, right? But there's one phrase I thought was a really good one that summarizes: Conway will help us design the organization and Little will help us establish flow. I think that's a really impactful statement. And of course, if listeners don't know what Little's law and Conway's law are, obviously this is a great prompt to go read the book, because you do a pretty awesome job, right, of like going into both and then bringing them together. And it's, I don't know, it stood out to me, so I enjoyed it.
It's, yeah, and the thing is, it's maybe I should have made it a little more circular, because I think those two will keep informing each other, because you're going to apply something like Conway's law to say, okay, this is how I want things to get done. So this is how I'm going to lay out my organization like this. This is how it will be. And then you will observe, based on Little's law, that your whip might be too high because you've laid your organization out like this. All right, let's change it up. How do I reduce organizational whip? By changing the structure of my organization. And then you'll see, okay, maybe the whip went too low, maybe it went too high, whatever that is. And then let's change it again. And it's a circular thing that will just keep happening. It'll just keep going on as your org grows, as your goals change. Those two things will play against each other and hopefully get you to a nice balance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really cool positive reinforcing loop. The way they would interact is if you, again, continue making those incremental improvements. Okay. Any other, Jeff, you got any more?
I don't have another zinger to end this on, but there's so many of them. I'll just make a plug for Pratik. Go listen to Pratik and Dan's podcast if you don't read the book, of course. But like, there's zingers in there all the time, so I enjoy it. Your guys's banter and your deep dive into very technical things is just you make things that some people would find very stale, very interesting and entertaining. So you guys do a great job with it.
Oh, thank you. One of the things that with all the work that Dan and I have been doing of late, especially in Dan's book, Dan's new book, Actionable Agile Metrics for Predictability Part 2, and all the Monte Carlo stuff that's in my book as well, almost every concept that we talk about, almost every basic concept that we talk about is from the first half of 20th century. Almost all those basic concepts, whether it's Shewhart, whether it's Deming, whether it's Monte Carlo itself, whether it's control charts, all these things are from 1950s, 60s, or above, or before. At some point, we started to forget about that stuff and came up with a whole bunch of other stuff to replace it. And that, for me, is the really cool part of it. It's going back to basics to establish flow and understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Beyond the book, is there anything else you want to plug?
Well, prokanban.org, Dan and I are intimately involved with prokanban.org. Please go check us out. There are lots of great trainers out there that will offer training and consulting around these concepts that we were just talking about. Dan and I ourselves run a few classes here and there. So check out Drunk Agile. If you haven't already, you might not learn much about Agile, but you'll learn a lot about whiskey.
If you found value in today's episode, share this with a friend. Until next time, get Agile and stay Agile.